others, go to democracynow.org and check out our travel in the coming days as Steal the Story, Please, the documentary about Democracy Now! Travels the country starting April 9th here in New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 90.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. I'm Al McFarland. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarland. I'm glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. Well, as you know, we're in the middle of our pledge drive and we've got important things to say and things to do. And the most important thing is to invite you, our dear listeners here on KFAI and around the world at KFAI.org, those who are connected through Black Press USA, through the Insight News YouTube channel, through our Facebook and our LinkedIn and our X platforms. We want to invite you to support this program, support this station by calling and or going online and making a pledge. We'll give you the pledge information over the course of the hour. And you know, want to hear from you too. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we'll put a link, a QR code, in the screen here, and I can read it to you who are listening on radio, how to join the show, how to come on and talk about your KFAI experience, your being a part of the KFAI family and this community. Also, if you're online checking us out, shout us out, leave a message in the chat, letting us know where you're listening from, what you like about the conversation with Al McFarland, about KFAI, about our community, what you're concerned about in the world today. I think there's a lot to be concerned about, a lot to be concerned about. And this is a place where we can have that kind of conversation. So we want to do that. You know, as I was thinking about this in the history of this show, I remember working with D. Henry Williams and Sandra Gaillard way back in the day, maybe 20, almost 30 years ago when I first started doing this program or the earliest iteration of it. And I came on as a co-host with Sandra Gaillard program. And then after she moved, was able to move into the host role. But it's been a wonderful experience just being here in KFAI, at KFAI, with KFAI in the community and connecting KFAI with the world that I'm a part of, that I see, that I know, that I believe, and the world that I, in my own mind, am trying to build, building that with you, listeners and viewers. And what are we building together? That's the question. What can we build together? And I think the answer is anything we put our minds to. And that kind of is the answer that's going to get us through the turbulence of the day. This morning, I was listening to some of my friends on Urban View on Sirius Radio, and they were talking about, you know, the movement of more troops into the Gulf region. And they had several people call in who were veterans who talked about why they chose to be in the Army and what their sense of mission and duty was. Some called and talked about wanting to be in the military as a way out of, you know, the difficulty and hardship of community, of being poor, how to get a leg up with education, training, experience, and travel. And some talked about being conscientious objectors. And some talked about for those who are facing the possibility of a draft now, it's being discussed, you know that. Is there an alternative if you're not a conscientious objector? What can you do? And one of the callers mentioned that she's 80 now, but back in her young youth had joined the Peace Corps and was in service with a number of young men who preferred to provide service to the country, to the community through the Peace Corps, rather than going to the Army, and that was an acceptable alternative. So we should look at what alternatives are available today for young men and women who are facing potential conscription, or simply looking at choices, how they want to engage, and looking at their sense of duty, of obligation to the country, to the culture, and the opportunity that military service can and should provide. As I said, I'm a veteran. I served in the U.S. Navy for a total of 6 years, two of those being active duty, four being reserve, and have stories to tell about being an African-American in the U.S. military. And I was in at a time where I was developing what I have sought to pursue, and that is a certain consciousness, a certain awareness about who I am in the world and what the world is and what it means to be alive, to be free, what it means to love, what hatred means and what hatred does, what advantage means and what advantage can do. Well, I talk about things like this all the time with people from around the country and around the world, and love to have you weigh in on the conversation as well. So if you want to be part of this conversation, I'd love to have you just drop a note in the comment section. I can share your notes with the people who are listening on the radio. I see Big Cheese has already weighed in. Thank you, Big Cheese. The question is, Al McFarland, I'll put it on the screen here. What do you think about the Ghanaian government recent visit to United Nations using the FBA, Foundation of Black Americans, to give reparations? Ghana was deeply involved in the slave trade. Great question. I'm glad you asked, Michelle. Thank you so much for being here. Greetings to you as well. So let me go back to your question, Big Cheese, and I'm interested in your point of view, because I'm sure that you and I are going to differ on this, and we're going to differ on this description of the meaning and the role of a foundational Black American. And so my point of view, Big Cheese, is that slavery was a global system, and that everybody that was involved in the problem has to be involved in the solution as well. And the solution is not a short-term transactional solution. It's a solution that's going to take the same amount of time as the problem took. And the problem we're looking at is a 500-year transgression, the committing of crimes against humanity. That's what President of Ghana, Mahatma, in fact, pull up the article, if you would, brother. Pull up the article that I have with issue. The current issue of Inside News is an article on Mahatma, President Mahatma, the president of Ghana, who spoke at the United Nations and condemned the slave trade, and said that reparations are due. And so that's how I feel. I think that this is not a question of just Americans. I think that the president of Ghana was not here to ask the U.S. to pay for Ghana. He was here to tell the world, the United Nations, that we as a planet have some work to do, have some business to take care of. And the business we have to take care of is what he called the greatest tragedy in the history of humanity, and that is the African slave trade. So pull up that article, Jared. Let me share that, and then Big Cheese, you and I can kick it on this a little bit. If you can make it bigger so I can read it. So, and I'm going to make it larger on my screen here. So the article, this is in today's or yesterday's issue of Insight News. Mahama leads historic UN vote declaring slave trade as humanity's gravest crime. Ghana's president wins a 123-nation majority for a landmark reparations resolution. Let me read the article out of New York, March 25th and 26th, 2026, in one of the most emotionally charged sessions in the United Nations General Assembly has seen in years. Ghana's president, John Dramani Mahama, stood before the world's nations and made history, addressing the assembly during a plenary session to mark the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade at the UN headquarters in New York. President Mahama called on member states to adopt a landmark resolution declaring the transatlantic slave trade the gravest crime against humanity, describing it as a critical step towards justice and healing. Mahama did not come to the podium simply as Ghana's head of state. He had been named the African Union champion on reparations, carrying the weight of an entire continent's demand for acknowledgement. A pull quote is him saying, "There's no such thing as a slave." So let me continue. President Mahama opened his 8-page address with a provocative declaration. He said there's no such thing as a slave. He explained that the victims of the trade were human beings. And you have to move it over, scroll over for me, Jared, or to the next page. Because I'm off of my reading area here. So we go to the next page of the story, where the story continues, the jump. And we're getting at, I think it's at the bottom of the page. Is that it? Nope, that's not it. And I think you passed it. Go back one page. Still don't see it. So keep scrolling through. We're finding it, and I'm reusing the issue edition of Inside News, and the story jumps from page one to Inside further. So keep scrolling till we find the story. Jared, if you would, it's not on this page. Keep going. Keep going. And keep going. In the meantime, those of you watching are seeing a beautiful newspaper. We've got just powerful stories. Keep going. Jared, turn the page. And I think that's it on this page at the bottom. So make it larger so I can read it. And I don't remember the last few words of the last paragraph, but I'll just go from here. It says, believe they could, you question the question of slavery. You know, how could somebody believe they could own another person as a personal property? It says, not if you acknowledge an individual's humanity, not if you respect an individual's basic right to dignity. Mahama argued that the foundation of the trade was a racial hierarchy designed to strip Africans of their humanity, a legacy that continues to fuel global inequalities today. So here's the detail. Mahama didn't permit the assembled diplomats the comfort of abstraction. He painted a harrowing picture of the transatlantic slave trade, describing how enslaved Africans were stripped of dignity and identity from capture on the continent to their eventual sale in foreign lands. He recounted how victims were held naked in dungeons, chained and forced onto ships where they endured the brutal Middle Passage under inhumane conditions, with estimates indicating that between 10 and 15% perished during the crossing, while others chose death over enslavement. He cited the sheer scale of the crime in geographic terms. Roughly 6 million enslaved Africans were trafficked to Brazil, nearly 2 million to Jamaica, about 500,000 to the United States, and over 450,000 to Barbados, an island that's only 34 kilometers long. So this vote, how did the world respond to his request for a declaration? The article continues that applause erupted in the UN General Assembly Hall as member states adopted the resolution. It received 123 votes in favor. Three countries, Argentina, Israel, and United States, voted against, and 52 abstained. The United States described the resolution as problematic, citing concerns about identification of intended beneficiaries of reparatory justice while still acknowledging the historical injustices involved. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for confronting slavery's lasting legacies of inequality and racism, urging the removal of persistent barriers preventing, now scroll over, thank you, people of African descent from exercising their rights. After the vote, Mahama was measured in his triumph. He described the outcome as a significant milestone, but cautioned that it marked only the start of a broader struggle, saying, "This is not the end, this is the beginning. What we've achieved today creates a platform for the struggle of reparative justice." He characterized the resolution not merely as an act of commemoration, but as a necessary step towards healing the wounds of racialized chattel enslavement, concluding, "The world is watching, and the area of reparatory justice has officially begun." So the full text of this transcript is available. At the Diplomatic Times Online, they published the complete text of the address to the General Assembly, in which he spoke on behalf of the African group regarding the draft resolution. It can also be read in other places here. So that's the story. That's the story. Let's take that down, Jared, and I'll go back to Big Cheese. What do you think? Let me look at your comments here. So you are saying that, let me make sure I get the latest ones. Yeah. Ghana owes the foundational Black Americans reparations for their role in the transatlantic slave trade. That's a point, okay? Your next post said, now you accuse Ghana and the Ghanaian government for scamming, and you're saying that they're now playing the victims. I disagree with you, but again, that's your opinion, brother or sister. My evidence of Ghanaian involvement in the slave trade is the Elmina Castle. Have you been there? Have you been to the slave castle? And Ghanaian chiefs made deals with the Europeans selling Black people for the slave trade. Yes, that is true. And others did as well. So, you know, that's it's a big story. And you know, from my point of view, the Big Cheese, it's not just a question of Washington and the descendants of those that were enslaved here. This is part of the globalization era that we are in. You know, the slave trade itself was globalization. So we've been part of the globalized world all along. And this is the evolution of our ability to rise, I think, organize, and use technology, use knowledge, use our genius to reset the table and reset the terms of engagement. And what is required right now and what is underway, I believe, is the formation of both processes, policies, attitudes, information, knowledge that will allow us to present our argument, first of all, to ourselves and then to the world. And the outcome of that will be a realignment, a resetting the table, and a way to ensure the prosperity of our people locally, globally, to redefine our relationships with the assets on the lands that we own, the countries that we have. You know, I'm so excited about what I keep reading and talking about in Burkina Faso, the work being done there to nationalize the mineral extraction systems and also the farming and agricultural systems and the transportation systems, and a principle that the Burkinabe have adopted is that they produce what they consume and they consume what they produce. And so that's another way of localizing and valuing your relationship to the land that you're on. And that's what we have done historically and what we will continue to do. And what will be different in the future, I believe, is our ability to do business with each other globally, supporting local entrepreneurship, supporting people on the ground level in ways that we haven't before, without the same level of middlemanship that is exploitative, extractive, and that operates a system of scarcity that drives pricing in the capital marketplace. So let me know what you think. That's my point of view. It's my thought. Love to hear your thoughts on it as well. I did in this same paper a major story on what's happening in our legislature, and I really want those who are listening to weigh in on this. In fact, again, love to have you comment on anything and everything we're talking about and bring your ideas to the show as well. And as I indicated, there's a QR code on the screen here right above me, where if you want to join the show, click on the code, we'll let you in and hear your point of view as well. I do want to say that towards the end of the show, I'm going to play a part of an excellent presentation that I was a part of, put on by Build Wealth Minnesota. And this is a panel on how people need to do things like insurance to protect their assets and protect their future. And something to pay more attention to and talk about more in our community. Well, let's see, I'm just double checking to see if there are any more posts from Big Cheese. Big Cheese, again, thank you so much for listening, for being here, and for sharing your point of view. I thank you just a lot. I want to thank also Marcus Bentley for his like on it, and appreciate you. Thanks for those who are connected by Black Press USA and those who are listening at the Insight News channel and at the Facebook channel. We appreciate all of you. In fact, tell somebody you know. Set a post out right now, a tweet or a post, or let someone know this conversation is going on and that they can join the conversation as well. I want to come back to the fact that we're doing our membership drive. And I don't know if Miguel is there in the studio or if there's someone there that can work with me on the pledge drive. But this is a time where we go to you, our listeners, invite you to support the channel, support the station, and support the conversation with Al McFarland. So if you've been listening, if you've been with me the years I've been on KFAI and in community, if you've been a fan of Insight News, then we think you're a fan of KFAI. And we'd love to have your support. We invite you to support by making a pledge. We've got some incentives. And before the hour is over, I'll ask a pledge partner to come online with me to let you know what things are available to you for making your pledge to support KFAI today. Well, again, I was thinking, again, going down memory lane about doing this show now for some number of years. And I was trying to remember the shows that had the most impact on me. And there were several, and there's probably no one, but there are several great shows. One of them, I remember, we were at Lewis Hill's Kitchen on 9/11, on that year, 9/11. And I remember driving from my home in North Minneapolis down to Lewis Hill's Kitchen where we did the live show. And the first tower had already been hit, but nobody knew what that meant. And so as I drove down to Plymouth Avenue, to the Plymouth Avenue Shopping Center, where we produced the show every week, we had the TV on in the restaurant. So we were monitoring the television feed while we were doing the show. Our guest that day was a Hollywood actor. Let me think of the brother's name right now. he was one of the stars in Get on the Bus, the story about the Million Man March, that group, Spike Lee's movie. He also was in town doing a one-man show. He played Huey Newton, the Black Panther, and was in town doing that. And if somebody remembers his name, put it in the chat, send me a chat or put a note in the comment sections. I'll think of it in a second. But I remember as we were doing our show and talking about his work as an actor, Roger Grunveer was his name. That's his name. Roger Grunveer was my guest that morning. And then as the show was going on, we saw the second plane hit the New York tower. And, you know, we didn't know what it meant. We didn't know what to do. I just remember we asked Wayne to do something like in honor of victims and maybe just a sound, 12 bells. And that was an intuitive suggestion, the spirit saying, let's ring a bell for the loss of lives that we're looking at as we're watching the screen here, watching here in Minneapolis. And I remember at the close of the show, Roger Grunveer and Wayne got up and jammed for 5 or 10 minutes, and they did Exodus, I think. And it was a spiritual moment where they were talking about Exodus moving Jaja people. Well, that was a great show. That was a great show. Great shows included interviews with Paul Wellstone, interviews with Al Sharpton, excellent interviews. One of the most exciting interviews I did was with the author of What America Owes to Black People, Randall Robinson. And so, brother, Cheese, Big Cheese, you know, that story, that interview was a great interview because he talked about the debt and the economic impact, the exploitation of extraction of African labor and the labor of Africans in the West, what that meant to this country, to wealth creation, and how he was advancing the argument for reparations. And what we did is attempted to globalize the conversation at that time. What we did that was unique is that we had sent two of our reporters to Berlin to interview German Jews who were negotiating reparations with the government of Germany for the theft of their labor and the loss of lives at the hands of the state, state-sponsored theft of property leading to loss of life of human beings. We call it the Holocaust, and that was that experience. So think about that. Reparations were made and paid for the theft of property and life and liberty. And that was because that was a policy of the state. The state actually was the criminal. Well, how do you look at the history of this country right now and look at the enterprise called slavery that was sanctioned by the state, state-sponsored criminality? What they did was a crime against humanity. It was a crime against humanity. And it was the policy and practice of the state. So the argument is not that this country simply owes to those of us who were survivors or descendants of that evil. The argument is to look at the global structures, the systems that produced, supported, maintained, and grew this process, and what the consequence of that is today. We went through the periods of both imperialism, of colonialism, and what they call neo-colonialism. What are the parallels between those experiences of domination and coercion of African people on African soil and African people on the soil of Western nations, of the United States, of the Caribbean, of Mexico and South America? African people nonetheless exploited their labor extracted through state action. reparations is the question. So again, love to have your point of view, your thoughts on that. And thank you, Big Cheese. Your last comment, everybody's getting cash reparations, tangibles, except for the foundation of Black Americans. And I think it's not a question of what they're getting, it's questions what we gonna get. What are we gonna do? What are we gonna organize? How will we move forward to describe and create systems and processes that recover what was stolen and recover and restore what was lost due to policies and practice of the state, of the country, of the government. Well, a reminder, this is Pledge Week. If you can support this conversation, if you like this conversation, be a part of it by supporting it, send a pledge. We have people available in the studio right now. In fact, Station, give me the number, maybe put the number on the screen below where people can call in and make their pledge right now. Jared, if you can put that up, that would be awesome. And there are people standing by to take your pledges right now, pledge to support the show. While we do that, I'm gonna go back to my issue of Insight News today and pull up the cover story for me, Jared. This is something I'm gonna be talking about for a while, and I'd love to have you weigh in on it. We're in a legislative session right now. And can you, let's see, pull up, I'll add this to the stage, but I don't know that I can control it. Can you go to the page one, Jared, the cover? Okay, so I want to go into this issue of the Senate passing or tabling a $100 million business relief bill. That happened days before the deadline. And why is this important? So, you know, Big Cheese, we are talking about how Minnesota businesses in general and businesses owned by Black people and people of color in particular were impacted by the surge when ICE showed up and disrupted traffic and lives and businesses and families and schools and churches and things like that. And so our state, our legislative leader, actually the president of the Senate, Bobby Joe Champion, authored and presented a bill. I think it was Senate File 4535, that might be the number, 4535, that proposed adding about $100 million as a one-time appropriation to support some of the businesses that were negatively impacted by the presence of ICE. Let me read that. And go into why it's important to have this conversation. And again, I want you to weigh in. If you own a business that was negatively impacted and you believe that the state should support you, how do we make that happen? Because this bill at this moment, to my knowledge, is dead, unless it gets brought back as part of an omnibus bill at the end of the session, which could happen. But let me share this story that I wrote in this week's edition of Inside News. What you can do to get this edition is go to issue issuu.com/insight news. There you'll find the digital edition of Insight News, and this story will be there as well. So I write that the $100 million relief package, can you make it larger, Jared, so I can read it better? It's still kind of small for me. Okay, great. Thank you. $100 million relief package for Minnesota businesses devastated by federal immigration enforcement operations faced procedural milestones Monday, this was a week ago, that included a sharp debate over who gets the money, how it's delivered, and whether the state should study the damage before acting on it. The question of whether to allocate $250,000 to study the impact of the ICE actions in Minnesota may have been the death knell for the hopes of entrepreneurs and agencies for whom the legislative relief would have been a lifeline. Scroll down a little bit. Other way. Oh, okay. The Senate Jobs and Economic Development Committee heard Senate File 4535, the Minnesota Business Recovery Loan Program authored by Senate President Bobby Jo Champion. That's my senator here in North Minneapolis, DFL of Minneapolis. But then it ended up passing a contested amendment. And after that, it tabled the bill with a suggestion that it could face another vote later and whether it would advance to the Finance Committee. As it turned out, Senator Champion said if it didn't pass in this committee, it probably would not go anywhere. So there was a 5-4 vote on both the amendment. The amendment was striking out the provision for $250,000 to study, to create an organized look at the impact of ICE and the surge. And I think in opposition to that, Senator Zainab Mohammed said, we don't need to study, and voted to kill that 250 and have that money added to the entire bill, making the entire bill 100 million or 100.25 million. But then after that, there was a motion to table the entire thing, which Senator Zainab supported as well, thus killing the bill. I'll read a little more. Senator Zainab Mohammed from District 63, who's also the committee's vice chair, kind of led the hearing's most pointed line of internal questioning. She said that the, go back up, the Senate file 4535 proposes a one-time appropriation from the Minnesota Forward Fund. It's $100 million for direct business relief. And as I said, the $250,000 set aside for a comprehensive statewide economic impact study. The money was proposed to flow through what they call community development financial institutions, CDFIs, and nonprofit lenders, and should be distributed as either grants or loans to provide working capital for businesses experiencing economic harm from immigration enforcement activities, particularly Operation Metro Surge, which began in December of 2025. And the funding, it was structured for two geographic streams. Scroll down or scroll up, please. $82 million was going to be going through certified CDFIs, Community Development Financial Institutions, and $18 million would go through the Minnesota Initiative Foundation, sort of a network for greater Minnesota. And under this bill, the CDFIs could draw from the pool and end up receiving 100% reimbursement for qualifying loans made to eligible businesses. And this would enable rapid decentralized deployment through lenders that already have relationships in the affected communities. The article goes on to explain what the loan eligibilities are. Scroll down some more if you would, Jared. And I won't go through all that. But then, you know, on this page, it says the hearing's first significant action was the adoption on a 5-4 vote of an amendment that deleted Section 2 of the bill. And that's the section that authorized the $250,000 for the economic impact study. And it restricted those funds for direct business relief as well. So that made the project worth $100.25 million. Go to the page 14, if you would, for the jump. Okay, and I make it larger so I can read it larger, larger, larger. Great. So I lay out in the article comments about the bill from Senator Susan Faw, who supported it, and comments from people who came to testify in support of the bill. The testifiers included Jenny Sieber, who was a 16-year business owner in Brooklyn Center. Testifiers included David Campagna, who is with the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. And also, scroll down a little bit, other testifiers were there. But also Mayor Nadia Muhammad, who was the mayor of St. Louis Park, she appeared as a witness supporting champions bill. One more testifier was Linda Sloan. Linda Sloan is the executive director of the Minnesota Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. So let me go to the summary. And then again, if you have comments on this, go to the scroll to the right, if you would, to the last two columns, Jared. Yeah. Scroll down a little bit. Scroll down. The stakes are high. There was a March 27th deadline for getting bills in. This one didn't go there, obviously, so this is dead as far as it's concerned. But this would have been one of the largest state economic, go back up, you moved. Okay. Okay, that's the right place. Would have been one of the largest state economic interventions for immigrant and minority businesses in Minnesota history. And the idea of zero interest forgivable loans represented a policy choice. And the policy is that it's an appropriate response to a federally induced economic shock. And that it's not really an additional debt burden, but it's creating accessible capital that rewards businesses for surviving and staying the course in their communities. The 5-4 committee vote, however, suggested that while the DFL leadership had the majority to move the bill, there was no margin for defection, and that is precisely what happened. The questions about whether more money should go to her district, Senator Zainab Mohammed, ended up causing the bill to not go forward. Scroll down a little bit. Thank you. The last paragraph in the story, it says the 5-4 committee votes suggested that while DFL leadership had the votes to move the bill, because there was a 5-4 majority, that there was no room for defection, and that the geographic equity concerns raised by Senator Mohammed could either strengthen the bill through amendment or complicate its path to the floor. Her willingness as vice chair to publicly challenge the bill's design signals that a follow-up hearing may be as contentious or may not happen at all. So, and I think it has not happened. So that's a story. $100 million doesn't get allocated, at least not in this bill. And the ostensible reason, you can take this down, Jared, is that that enough money wasn't being directed to the Lake Street or South Minneapolis area. And for that reason, nothing's going to happen. So it's just conversation worth having in the future. Big Cheese says, I'm sorry, Alan McFarland, but the Somalian community has made the block hot. And and you're painting the Somali community with a broad brush, and I think that's not appropriate either, brother. So look, again, thank you all for being here. Thank you for listening. And we want to invite you to support the show by supporting KFAI and pledging to support. And people are standing by here at the station right now that can help you take your pledge. You can also go to kfai.org to donate. Actually, the drive ended Friday, but we're just thanking you and saying that when you, we had a successful drive, and thank you all for making that, but you can still support us. And you can do that by going to kfai.org to donate. Let me close the show out with a part of a show that I did earlier in the year from the Build Wealth Minnesota effort. And this was a panel on insurance. Check it out. I'll introduce it. Jared, put it up.
Building legacy here today, and we're protecting our legacies, and now we're turning to ensuring our legacy. And in my life, I sold insurance for a time for Mutual of Omaha years ago, but that's a whole nother story. This final panel is going to shine a light on something that we really can't overlook, and it's protecting our families through the proper coverage and through the proper and owner of State Insurance Company. Ondred Alexander Insurance Agency. And I love saying your name, DJ Wilder, the insurance agent of Country Financial. Hello and welcome. This is our panel, everyone. I just want to start with, why is that insurance in Black families is most often the overlooked part of legacy building? And BJ, let's start with you.
You hear me? Okay. Well, I would say it's the two reasons, a couple of stigmas within the Black community. When I first started this in the industry, my upline, like a lot of uplines will tell you when you first start, what you want to do is make a list of 50 people, friends, family. These are all the people that you're going to go after.
You're talking about selling?
Well, yes.
Insurance. Okay.
Insurance, yeah. And these are the people that you're going to talk to about your insurance. A couple of the first people that I talked to, two of my best friends, and actually my mom. And as soon as I talked to all I did was ask the question. I was like, so, and they tell you that's this. So what do you think about insurance? And as soon as I mentioned to my friends and my mom, all of them was like, don't do it. It's a scam. Don't. I feel like that's a stigma in the Black community. Number one, insurance really isn't going to be there for you when you need it to be. But then also second, like Brother Crumble was up here saying, a lot of times what we're taught in the Black community is this is what you have to do to survive. You have to make sure these kids eat. You got to make sure the lights stay on. You got to make sure you can get to work, as opposed to what you have to do to thrive. And I feel like insurance, you know, life insurance, things like that are more along those lines of something that you could do to thrive. And that's just not at the forefront of our mind. So I feel like that's why it's overlooked a lot of time, because it's just not something that was taught to us and ingrained in us since we were young, like it is in other communities and cultures.
Andrew, why do you think it's often overlooked?
Can you hear me? So first of all, I just want to say thank you for inviting me to be here. I know David and I go way back, and he's had the pleasure of hearing me talk about insurance, the importance of insurance. And one of the things, and the other thing is, I appreciate the fact that we were given these questions ahead of time, because it really gave me an opportunity to really think about, you know, what, why. And I would say the biggest reason is focus and priority. There's a lot of cultural factors that weigh into it, as far as having, you know, deep-rooted mistrust in the community that the community has for the insurance industry. Historically, there's just been a lot of, you know, mistrust there. The difference of immediate versus long-term thinking. Oftentimes, as a community, we get stuck on the here and now and not really focus on what can happen in the future. The perception of cost and also the complexity and confusion. I just want to say, for me, thinking about insurance has been a journey. I really started my career as an entrepreneur in real estate. And I used to own a real estate company. I was a real estate broker. I did real development. And when the housing market crashed, I really was left holding the bag. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that I did not have the right insurance in place. I did not really understand how to mitigate my risk. And I think that's something that a community, we suffer from a lot. And so when the housing market crashed, I decided to leave real estate. I really wanted to have a much better understanding of why am I seeing all of or so many of my white counterparts out here being able to survive this market. And I was finding myself closing my doors, filing bankruptcy. And again, it had to do with not mitigating that risk. So I spent probably about 3 or 4 years after that working on my PhD and really trying to understand why our community, why our community didn't really use and understand and why were our businesses failing at a higher rate than white-owned businesses, basically. And a lot of it had to do with the way that we perceive and we mitigate risk. And when I say perceive and mitigate risk, it's really how do we think about insurance? How do we think about insurance as a community? And so I think that has had a huge impact. And okay, now I lost focus on that. I was getting on my soapbox, but yeah. So yeah, that's. I'll go ahead and leave it up to you, Davina.
Go ahead, Ms. Baldwin.
Giving this question some thought, I guess the biggest thing I would say is insurance is very sexy. Insurance is nothing that we can drive around. We don't get immediate gratification from an insurance policy. So when we sit down with our clients, we're on a mission to pay and the value, maybe.
Were you going to hold?
Okay. Okay, I'm just going to have to try to project my voice. No, it's good. Okay, so we're trying to paint a picture and let someone know this bill that's coming too often, too high, is going to be that thing that could keep them in their house. It could be that thing that is going to help them if they have disability insurance to make those mortgage payments if somebody's sick. And we have to work pretty hard at that messaging, because when you're dealing with intangibles, you know, you'll even start the policy. And that was one of my biggest frustrations. State Farm emphasized a lot of selling of life insurance for us to be able to keep our jobs. But what would happen with my book is I would sell the policy, but it would lapse out. So it's not only selling it the first time, you got to sell it over and over. So I'm talking to my client and I convince them that, okay, this is worth that $50. But now we have things going on in our lives as Black folks. Hey, I don't got the money, Davina. What am I going to do? You know, I gotta choose. And then we start the policy. We might drop the policy. We might come back to the policy. And it's just keeping, I guess, the message alive that you're taking this policy out so that you can keep your dreams alive. You want to keep your family in your home. You want to keep your child. If something happens to you, you still want your child to get that education. Dreams, legacy, that's what it's all about. And it's not always easy when you just see it as a bill initially.
Makes a lot of sense. And I'm going to do as Al did and combine a couple of questions for you. So you mentioned that life insurance or insurance is not very sexy. But how do you start that conversation on a non-sexy topic and without fear, without discomfort? And also, what kind of insurance should every family have? And BJ, you're looking at me. How do we start?
Well, I would say as far as starting that conversation without fear or discomfort, you probably can't. I mean, well, you could, but if you want to be effective, you probably can't. For most people, when you start that life insurance conversation, a lot of times when agents will talk to you, they'll tell you the first thing you should ask somebody is, if you were to not make it home today, How would your family survive? How would your family fare with you not being there? And immediately when you bring that up, it's, you know, talking about someone's mortality. So it's there's fear there. There's a little bit of discomfort there. People don't like to talk about that. But honestly, you have to get at people's pain point to make it an emotional thing, to make them understand if something were to happen to you, your family is here. What is it that needs to happen to make sure that your family taken care of? Because they're already having to deal with a tragedy. They're already having to deal with the loss of you. You don't want to have them to deal with on top of that. Oh, now the kids got to move out. Now we got to move schools. Now we got to figure out a way to do this and to do that. So I feel like the conversation can be had, but it has to start with a little bit of fear and discomfort just to be able to really get to that pain point to understand why this is so critical.
Andrew, is that the tack that you would take in helping to mitigate the discomfort or the fear? And what types of insurance should you start with?
I don't know. I think it works. Okay. I don't know if that tactic that I take, and I work with my clients, it's really about helping them understand that insurance is a tool. It's a tool that you want to have in place to protect your family, to protect your property, and to also to give you a peace of mind. So oftentimes when people come to my office and ask about insurance, it's usually because someone else is forcing them to. They're looking to buy a home, so I have to have homeowners insurance. Or, you know, I have a car, so I have to have that insurance. Or, you know, in order for me to get this contract, I have to have general liability policy in place. And what I try to help my clients understand is it's not about what somebody else wants for you, but it's what do you want for yourself? How are you protecting your property? How are you protecting your business? This isn't about doing this for someone else, but you're doing this for your family. You're doing this to, again, create a legacy. When you're looking at life insurance isn't about you. It can be, if depending on how you use it as a tool. You can have a life insurance policy that is designed to give you benefits before you die and also after you die. But it has to be part of a plan. You shouldn't look at insurance as an expense that I have to have. You want to look at your legacy and how is insurance going to play its role in helping me achieve my goal. So,
Ms. Baldwin, how do you feel about that question? Need your mic.
Testing. Okay. When I sit down with a person, I guess I try to take the conversation away from the obvious death conversation. I want to say, what do you want this policy to do for you? So we'll just try to take them on a journey, and we often use the acronym LIFE, starting with loans, then income replacement, then final expenses, education, and you can kind of see them just start to dream, you know, about having these things. And when we start this conversation, it's always funny though, because people will kind of say, well, wait a minute now, that's going to be too much. You know, if we project out how much income they're going to earn over their lifetime, and we say, okay, so this is what the number would be if you want 20 years of income, if you want this thing to provide 20 years of income, they'll start backing off. And then I'll have to say, well, wait, no, come on back. Because all we're doing right now is we're trying to get a plan, like you say, Ingrid. We're trying to just put a plan down. We're going to dream. If you could have the perfect policy, if this thing could become you, if you're not here, what do we want it to do? That's all we're talking about right now. Let's not think about the budget. We'll come back to that. So we get all their plans on paper, and then they can kind of see it a little bit more clearly. And then it's time then to talk. Now let's talk about budget, because I know my budget. I don't know your budget. So I want you to have a plan that's affordable. If you have a little hiccup, when I started out as an agent, we were a little hungrier. You know, okay, we're going to do this one. Now you can make it work. We can squeeze this money. You're going to do it. But now I'm a little calmer with the messaging. Hey, what can you afford? I want.
Great messages, a wonderful conference held by the Build Wealth Minnesota organization. It was the Black Men's Legacy Summit. They'll be holding it again this year. I'm Al McFarland. Thank you all for, let me say, yeah, I was off.